Is the senator from Minnesota going to tell us which episode that was?
I don't know. That's why I was asking.
That's not funny.
If I knew, I wouldn't ask her.
No, it's not. Don't laugh at him. It's not funny. I'm Jeff Horwich. It's In the Loop. And as you can hear there, people want so badly for Al Franken to be funny. You know, you watch these Sotomayor hearings and the crowd in the room is just, you're grasping for any scrap, any hint of humor that they can find. And I really want Al Franken to be funny too. I seriously do. But right now we just have to admit that he's just not funny. And he's in deliberately unfunny mode. He's trying to shore up his credibility. You know, I watched a clip of him the other day. He was on Letterman, I think this was in 2006, just before he had declared his candidacy for Senate. And he was so quick, so easy with his humor. He was so smooth. Now, totally different. He's so guarded. It's like he can hardly put a sentence together. Or he's so tired, he can't really tell. But where's the spark? This is him doing an interview on our local morning edition the other day.
You know, any candidate will say, well, I don't want a judicial activist and who decides, you know, legislates from the bench. But if you look at this court or the Rehnquist court, you'll see that the under the definition of, you know, voting to overturn established precedent, voting to overturn Congress, that Clarence Thomas is the most, if that's your definition, is the most judicious, you know, the biggest judicial activist.
Oh, spit it out, man. Imagine, you know, 4 minutes of that. That's basically what that interview was. Not that it doesn't make sense when you chart the individual words and what their meanings are, but where's the fire, you know, where's the energy, the inflection? He sounds so restrained. And is this what modern politics does to a vibrant, otherwise coherent guy like Al Franken, who basically speaks for a living? I think we need more humor, more humanity in our public officials. And to those people in the galleries of the Sotomayor hearings, you know, Al Franken maybe represents some hope of that. But he knows, probably better than anybody, that humor in particular is dangerous, especially now. You just never know when a camera's going to be on you. Consider, for example, John McCain's shining moment of diplomacy.
That old Beach Boys song, Bomberan. Bom, 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 bom. Anyway.
So that's it. That's the whole thing. That's all it took. And Sandon Totten, our producer, has come by the studio. Sandon, welcome.
Hey, Jeff.
And were you like me when you first saw this YouTube video, were you a little surprised? I mean, I'd figured from all the fuss made about that, that he had gone up on stage and sung three verses with a chorus line and a big brass band or something.
Yeah, in my head, I have heard like dance remix versions of that go on for 6 minutes. So I don't know how it was that short.
Yeah, as an interesting example of just why these guys need to just walk on eggshells, the littlest slip, I guess. Before we move on to the other stuff that we have in the podcast, there's a lot of good stuff coming up. I asked you to check into this question of humor in the Senate in particular and just see if you could find us any. How'd you do?
Not too well. Let's just say the Senate, they're a little humor challenged. And I'm going to make my case by referencing jokes that the senators themselves told.
Okay, so where did these come from?
There's this comedy website, Zug.com. They pulled a prank where they basically sent out a letter to all 100 senators pretending to be a 10-year-old boy working on a project, asking them, you know, tell us your favorite joke. Despite that, despite, you know, prodding with emails after that, they only were able to get 15 jokes out of the 100 senators. And I use the word jokes lightly here.
Like,
take this one from Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah. He says, learn from the mistakes of others. You can never live long enough to make them all yourself.
It's not a joke.
Right. They get a little bit better. Like, there's this one from Barbara Mikulski from Maryland, a Democrat. Why didn't the skeleton cross the road?
I don't know.
Because he didn't have any guts. And then she goes on to say, always have the guts to stand up for what you believe in. Because she couldn't just tell a joke. She had to make it some sort of
makes me cringe.
Inspirational thing for the 10-year-old.
Okay. Do they get any better?
Well, okay. I kind of like this one from John Corzine, a Democrat, former senator from New Jersey. What did the number 0 say to the number 8?
I don't know.
Nice belt. It works good on paper.
That's good. No, it works. It works. It works, period. I like that.
Chuck Hagel sent this one in, Republican from Nebraska. He says, Latin isn't dead. It's just roaming around.
Maybe good for a 10-year-old who's had a world history class
maybe
by that point.
And then Larry Craig, of all people, sent in a joke. He said, why did the farmer run over the field with a steamroller?
I don't know.
He wanted to grow mashed potatoes.
Hey, well, an Idaho potato joke.
Yeah, playing to his base there.
But, you know, Larry Craig should have many better jokes to tell.
Right. We all have great jokes about Larry Craig. So, you know, he should prepare himself to have some on the rebound there.
Well, why is it, you know, why is the Senate such a tough place to find humor?
Well, I asked that same question to J.T. Rushing. He's a writer for The Hill, a congressional paper, and he covers the Senate. And he said, you know, it was designed specifically not to be a fun or funny place.
The founding fathers designed the Senate to be a stodgy place with a slow pace, to be the place where legislation comes to die. That tends to make it a little less funny because there's a lot of frustration here.
So that almost seems like the exact place you'd need someone to show up with, like, a whoopee cushion or a joke or something, because it seems so tedious. Is it something about the personalities that the Senate attracts? Or?
Well, that is part of it, because they're all very smart, so they're not going to say anything politically incorrect. By the time most senators get here, they are older in life, frankly, lost their funny bones. I did a story last week about Franken, and a lot of senators said the same thing. Keep your sense of humor. A lot of them want him to bust out a little bit and lighten things up.
So you've covered the Senate for a while now. Do you remember laughing much? You ever remember a moment that just cracked you up?
There are several things that have made me laugh. One senator from North Dakota, Kent Conrad, often brings his dog into the Senate. And it's just odd to see this little white mutt wandering around these ornate hallways. And the only thing that's funnier than that is he has a legislative aide hold him whenever he goes into the Senate chamber. So there's this aide, probably worked all the way through college, you know, finally got to Congress, and here he is holding a senator's dog.
That's funny kind of in a sad way, but
yeah,
certainly
yeah,
funny.
He's got to be wondering, you know, I went to college for this.
And so you were saying the House is slightly different. I just wanted to get your take real quick on what's different about the House.
They're a little younger. It's just a little bit more chaotic and a little bit more unruly. It's like a big romper room. All of that lends itself to being a little bit looser.
But no dogs.
No dogs that I know of. I'm just based here in the Senate, but no, I certainly haven't seen any dogs being held by legislative aides outside the House chamber, no.
So, obviously, if the funniest thing that's happened in the Senate in the last year or so is a guy with a dog standing in the hallway, you can see why they're all hoping Franken will show up and throw some decent one-liners out.
Yeah, the signs are not good so
right.
far.
But there is one shining star of comedy in the Senate, a very new senator who also happens to be from Minnesota, Senator Amy Klobuchar. She was declared by the Washington Post as the funniest new senator, and by all accounts, she just killed the audience at the press dinner earlier this year. Listen to her work the crowd here.
Now, you have to imagine what this was like at the beginning. I didn't know anyone in Washington. No one would return my calls. No one could say my name. And I finally decided I'm just going to call everyone I know for money. And that is when I set an all-time United States Senate record. This is true. I raised $17,000 from ex-boyfriends. Now, Speaker Pelosi, I may have the record in the Senate, but I know in the House that record is held by Barney Frank.
Wow. Well, she's not just making a joke. She's making a gay joke.
Yeah, pretty risky.
I mean, a good-natured one, and obviously it went over well. But...
Right. In the context, you know, it's at a press dinner. I don't know if she'd do that on the floor, but...
Right. But that's what you don't hear much of until... senators leave office, or they don't think they've got any risk anymore, you know?
Right.
And then they can play around a little bit. Here's one that I saw the other day. This is it's not a gay joke, but it's making fun of another population of Americans. This is Tom Daschle, used to be the Senate Majority Leader from South Dakota, and this was after he was done with the Senate, making some stops around the state.
And I went to one of the nursing homes in town to say hello to some friends there, and there were three older men who were watching television that morning, and I shook their hands, and I said, do you know who I am? They said, no, but if you go to the front desk, they'll tell you.
Wow. Old people. That's like a serious voting block you don't want to mess with there.
I know. It's a funny joke.
Right.
And obviously, his crowd loved it. So a good politician knows how to read the crowd, and, you know, once a politician, always a politician. Here's a joke, though, that maybe didn't land so well. This guy was in office at the time, though he's in a lame duck situation, and he makes it clear he doesn't feel like he has a lot to lose. This is Dick Cheney in a speech from just about a year ago.
We'd always known about the Cheney family line on my father's side of the family. was back to Massachusetts in the 1630s. My grandmother was named Tyler, but it turned out she was descended from a Richard Cheney, same the last name who landed in Maryland in the 1650s. So we had Cheneys on both sides of the family. And we don't even live in West Virginia. But you can say those things when you're not running for re-election.
Making fun of entire states, I don't know, a little risky as joke material, perhaps.
Yeah, well, West Virginia is pretty solidly Republican. I don't know if he's got too much to worry about.
That's true, although that one was a bit much for people to stomach. I think Cheney's office actually had to issue an apology about that one, showing that it's never too late to make an ill-placed joke as a politician. So anyway, Sandin, thanks very much for finding us, well, a few glimpses of humor in the Senate. Maybe Al Franken will loosen up and give us a few more. What do you think?
We can only hope.
All right. Sandin Totten, producer here at In the Loop. As always, I was searching for musical inspiration this week, and watching those Senate hearings and following all the to-do about Sonia Sotomayor, one phrase sang to me above all else. Three words. I think you probably know what they are. So ubiquitous, so musical in their own right, so fraught with implication and controversy, they simply had to have a song. And so here it is, kind of stripped down this week, just me and a piano. Sonia, this one's for you. Sort of.
When I look back on my life, all the things that I've done wrong, all the better choices I might have made, the things I didn't know about, the times I wasn't strong, tough decisions, they left me so afraid. What I need to set me right, help me through the night. What I need, oh, what I need is a wise Latina woman. Yeah, 'cause she'll know we can make a world for us. With her by my side, she's my conscience, my history, my cure. The barbs and accusations, well, we'll take it all in stride. Safe beneath those robes, I feel so sure. What I need, so I can be my best, get a few things off my chest. What I need is a wise Latina woman. Oh, 'cause she'll know, she'll know. Trauma and the pain, the anger and the shame, the world a guy like me can't understand. And when I don't get it, she'll take me by the hand. And what I need, oh, what I need, oh, what I need is a wise Latina woman. Oh, 'cause she'll know, she'll know, she'll know, she'll know.
A little different from my usual. Randy Newman-esque, some people have said on the Facebook page. Never know what I'm going to get when I sit down to write one of those. And in this case, I wanted to write it and get it out there, especially quickly, because the clock is ticking on that particular phrase. I think in a week, no one will care. So there you have it. And as seems to be our habit nowadays, if you want to see a video of that sucker, Sandin came on up with a second camera, and we did this kind of cheesy two-camera shoot of my recording it up in the big music studio here at Minnesota Public Radio, which is where the piano was. So that's at loopfacebook.net or on our website, intheloopshow.net. Moving right along to something vaguely, well, not really related at all, in fact. U.S. stock markets have been sort of ambling along, you know, down one day, up the next. Usually the Japanese markets move somewhat in tandem. But the Japanese stock market is basically at the lowest point it's been in 2 months. It was up slightly as I'm talking to you right now, but before that, it fell for 9 straight days, which is pretty significant. So let's talk about Japan, because there's some cool political stuff happening there as well. That's why I've got Margarita Estevez Abe on the phone with me. And in addition to having an extremely cool name, she recently published a book called Welfare and Capitalism in Post-War Japan. And she's a professor of poli-sci at Syracuse. Margarita, thanks very much for your time.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
And I'll just mention for people that it's a little echoey where you are, because you're in Turin, Italy, in a very old building where you're doing some research, correct?
Yes.
Why do people seem so freaked out at this moment about the Japanese economy?
Japan's still the second largest economy. And after the first largest economy, the U.S., has failed, Chinese economy has gone down. And I think people are just surprised how badly Japan's doing, because its banks were all right. So there was no financial crisis in Japan. But nonetheless, Japanese economy just almost immediately after it, the U.S. economy went down. It went down and it's just going further down.
But now I've been watching this and it seemed like the Japanese economy was beginning to maybe crawl out of a long slump. But then literally just the last month or so, it seems like things have been extremely dire. Are people just waking up to just how bad it is?
Yeah, I think it's just very important we don't only focus on the stock market sort of movement.
Mm-hmm.
There is something extremely structural here. The bubble economy burst in Japan in the early 1990s, and Japan went through an extremely long recession that just went on for years and years. And it was only around 2004 that the Japanese economy picked up, almost solely thanks to the increasing demands from China and the U.S.
Hmm.
Japan is in a situation where two of its major trading partners are not buying as much as from Japan. And another thing is this, that even when Japanese exporters make profits, well, right now they're not making profits, but even if they started to export more to the China and the U.S., they have completely become sort of different kind of companies. Their profits used to trickle down to ordinary Japanese people in terms of more jobs and higher wages, but that has ceased to happen. So in a sense, what we have here is Japan's going through a transformation, but not really finding its own exit. So even when Japanese companies do well, people not making money, and without the sort of people making money, there's no domestic economic stimulus. Mm. And no one seems to know how to come out of this in Japan.
And I guess that's just sort of settling in, that nobody has the answer.
Yeah, and it's kind of sort of ironic that when the financial crisis hit the U.S. last fall, the immediate reaction of Japanese policymakers and journalists was that it was a U.S. problem, as if they didn't know how dependent their economy was on the U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm.
Many policymakers and journalists actually were giddy. Their reaction was, look at the U.S., the U.S. market capitalism has failed, and the sun will rise again. That, you know, this is how we are going to show to the Americans that our capitalist model is just better than theirs.
Oh, okay.
And this euphoria probably just lasted about weeks, and then it went.
So if, as you said, Japanese politicians, the ones who are in charge anyway, have been talking about the economy in extremely rosy terms, that makes a certain amount of sense, I guess, because they're kind of on the ropes. And politically, Japan might be in for a huge historic event, it's fair to say, next month. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think that the opposition party, Democratic Party of Japan, is going to win. People have been predicting this for some time.
Which is a big deal historically. Why, again?
Yes. The current ruling party, the Liberal Democratic Party, was formed in 1955. And ever since 1955, they've been in power, except for a very brief period when they were ousted. But that only lasted about 10 months. Basically, Japan has never, ever seen any change in power.
It makes an American's heart swell, I guess, to think about Japan maybe having an opposition in charge for a while.
Yes. And I think the Japanese voters, at this point, they don't really care what Democratic Party of Japan is like. They just want to see a change in power. And I think it's a very healthy attitude and completely long overdue.
What do we need to know about the guy who might be likely the next prime minister, Yukio Hatoyama?
Well, this is slightly disappointing, in my view. Very much like the current very unpopular Prime Minister Aso, he too is the grandson of a very famous post-war prime minister in Japan. So in this sense, it's very hard to say that he's bringing in any fresh blood into Japanese politics. And he's a very sort of scholarly person, hasn't really been known to be a shrewd politician. Politically, his quality as a leader is pretty much unknown.
So Hatoyama, he's not the Barack Obama type?
No. There is one very popular politician in the DPJ. Some Japanese journalists are calling him Japan's Obama.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Sumio Mabuchi. He's very charismatic, and he's a great communicator. He's a policy wonk, and also his whole sort of personality is quite interesting. He started out as a businessman, and he has a big family. He has five children. It just seems, at least, this is a perception. People think that he got involved in politics because he cares for the future of his children.
Do you think there's something actually there? Is that somebody who gives you hope for the Japanese political system and economy?
Well, there I'm sort of pessimistic. I'm very excited about the upcoming elections, but just whoever the leader is going to be, it's just going to be a tough ride in terms of the economy.
Well, Margarita, thanks very much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Margarita Estevez Abe is Associate Professor of Political Science at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse. She recently wrote a book called Welfare and Capitalism in Postwar Japan. I'm Jeff Horwich. This is In the Loop. And aside from Wise Latina Woman, one of the other big memes bouncing around the world over the last few days has been more time. We need more time, says President Obama, for the stimulus to kick in, for us to see the signs that the recovery is starting. Republicans, of course, are not anxious to give him a lot more time. So we sent a question out to our email list, which you can join, by the way, if you're not on it yet, asking, what are you looking for? What is your economic indicator here? And we got notes back very quickly from a whole bunch of people, some seeing some good signs, some not. A number of people, of course, said, duh, when friends, family, and acquaintances stop losing their jobs and having their hours cut, then maybe I'll think things are getting better. Craig in Blaine, Minnesota, says when he doesn't feel every single day like he's about to lose his job, like the rest of his department, which has moved to India, then he'll know the recovery is here. Wally in Golden Valley says he's been watching his stock portfolio, which is apparently still in the tank. And Wally says, you know what we've got for the stimulus so far? Bupkis. Good word, Wally. First time we've used it on the show, I think. So thanks. But Susan in St. Paul, on the other hand, says she's seeing modest gains in her retirement account. And a number of people noted the amount of stimulus-funded road construction they're having to drive around every day. That is certainly true here in the Twin Cities. And Ruth in Oakland, California, says thanks to the stimulus, solar panels are going up everywhere out there. And her civil engineer cousin has been really busy with lots of stimulus-stimulated transportation work. Here's one especially tangible economic indicator that surprised us a little bit from a listener here in Minneapolis.
My name is Kay Kirscht, and in my spare time, I sit for cats. Kitty, you want to say something? I believe the economy must be getting better because people are traveling once again. And they're traveling, and they're boarding their cats with me. I'm pretty much booked solid through August. There was a long time where I didn't have any calls whatsoever because people were staying home. My cat sitting business is back in business again.
I know Sandin worked very hard to get the right sound from Kay's cats. That's very comforting. Almost makes you forget about this big old recession we're in. The question again is, what economic indicators people are looking for to spot the recovery. And we heard from a couple other folks that really wanted to follow up with. One of them is Carol Montana, who lives in Grahamsville, New York. And Carol, you said you've been looking for a job for a while, right?
Yeah, I was laid off in April of 2007. I'm looking for work as a writer or a proofreader or an editor.
Tell me what your ideal job might be right now. Maybe that's not even nice to ask you.
No, that's cool. That's a cool question. Right now, my ideal job would be if someone who is putting together a book or a series of brochures or something would call me and say, I want you to proofread this for me. I love proofreading. I know it's really tedious for a lot of people. Mistakes jump out at me like neon lights on Broadway. Just yesterday, I saw in a in an arts brochure a mistake that someone told me had the brochure had been proofread four times.
So what's going on with the proofreading industry? Is spelling one of the casualties of the recession?
I don't think they think it's important enough to pay to have somebody do it. Every time I pick up a menu in a restaurant, I see a mistake in it. So I just don't think people think it's important right now.
So perhaps when people start investing again in their spelling and grammar, we'll know that the recession is easing.
In the meantime, I have started with a friend an online newspaper. We just had a newspaper in Sullivan County, New York here that closed. And we write up little stories and post photos. So at least it's keeping me off the streets.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because if you were on the streets, we wouldn't be able to call you up and ask you questions about your financial situation. Carol, very nice to talk to you. Thanks very much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. And good luck with what you're doing.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
All right, let's do another one of these. Mark Simmel out in Carlsbad, California, wrote something that I didn't entirely understand, and so it was intriguing to me. Mark works for a company that makes electromechanical products that go into all kinds of things, and he says he will sense things are turning around when he sees an increase in the sense of urgency when it comes to serious customer commitment to production orders, forecasts, and schedules.
Right.
Tell me what you mean there, and I presume you're in a line of work where that makes sense to you.
Well, a good example of that is, you know, for example, the company I work for does a lot of work for the automotive big three and other manufacturers.
Uh-huh.
We are currently observing a lot of, what would you call it, requests for quotes. I mean, that's what starts the business going. Here's a lot of potential business, but the uncertainty behind the forecasts that they base this business proposal on is all over the map.
So the big three automakers in this case, they're kind of poking at you, feeling you out, you know, asking questions, asking for quotes, but they're not signing on the dotted line.
Yeah, that's putting it very precisely. I mean, that's essentially what they're doing, is they're putting us through a lot of exercises in terms of, you know, different scenarios that they're trying out for size, if you will. It's just a malaise, if you will, where people are so afraid of making a commitment that they can't live up to because of the uncertainty. All the way down the supply chain, we're having trouble trying to second guess what their needs are really going to be and making appropriate plans to fulfill those needs.
And Mark, I just called you up randomly on what I presume is your cell phone here, so you didn't make an appointment or anything. Who's whistling?
Who's whistling? We've got a worker back here who's got a pretty high-pitched whistle.
And he was apparently in a decent mood today.
Yeah, it's lunchtime, so I guess he's taking it easy, but he started whistling. But yeah.
Oh, so yeah, it can't be all bad, because that dude is whistling a happy tune, apparently.
Yeah. He's got a job still. That's, you know, one thing to be said for it.
Worth whistling about. All right, Mark, thanks very much for letting me catch you here for a few minutes.
No worries at all.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Mark Simmel, near San Diego, I think. And let's end with the words of listener Sean Farman in Champlin, Minnesota, who suggests that the ultimate sign for the turnaround might not be something physical we might observe, but within our own minds. A little more philosophical take from Sean. He says people should stow away the idea that there is something to get back to and just be content with the changes that have come. Live life, trust that the sun will rise in the morning, come up with some good ideas, share them, and move on. Recovery complete. Thank you, Sean. Something to think about. And thanks to everybody who responded to our questions on this. If you want to get on that list, click on Join the Loop Network at InTheLoopShow.net, and you'll get these questions in the future. All right, now on to our last segment of the podcast here. This should be fun. I'm looking forward to it. We don't interview a lot of book authors. It's just not really a staple of what we do. But as much as we talk about Facebook on In the Loop, and as much as we use Facebook as a serious tool for building the show, somebody at Doubleday was very savvy when they popped a copy of this new book in my mailbox the other day. The Accidental Billionaires, The Founding of Facebook, A Tale of Sex, Money, Genius, and Betrayal. I read it. Ben Mezrich wrote it. And he's sitting in a studio in Boston. And now we're going to talk about it. Ben, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
First off, let's just get this out of the way. How does Facebook like your book?
I think their quote is they called me the Jackie Collins or Danielle Steele of Silicon Valley. So, you know what? They were terrified of it while I was writing it. I spent a lot of time trying to get to Mark.
Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO and founder of Facebook.
Creator of Facebook. He didn't want to talk to me, which is his right. But they were nervous about it. Honestly, I don't know if they've read it yet. But I think if they read it, they might like it better.
Well, they imply that there's a lot of fiction involved more than there is actual reportage. They don't want people to mistake this for journalism. I'm sure you would disagree with that assertion.
Well, I mean, I would disagree. I think there are a lot of journalists who don't like the way I write. I take a true story, I research the heck out of it, I find out everything I can about it, and then I write it in a cinematic narrative way. But you know what? There will be old school journalists who don't quite get this sort of new wave or the way I write, and that's fair.
My sense after wrapping it up was that you basically wrote the history of the founding of Facebook from the perspective of the people who got screwed by it along the way.
You know, I would hopefully I did something a bit more objective than that, but certainly a lot of my sources had access to Grind. And I really wrote a story about a couple college kids. If anything, it's more like the movie Superbad than anything else. It was two kids who were essentially trying to meet girls. You know, they were losers. They were kind of geeky kids at Harvard, Eduardo Saverin and Mark Zuckerberg. And their friendship fell apart as Mark took the company to the next level. So I definitely did tell a story about people who feel they were wronged.
One of the big ideas that you raise along the way, and it's, I gather, sort of, impossible to prove or sealed under court order, I don't know, is that he originally might have ripped off the idea of some other Harvard students to make Facebook. Is that what you came to believe?
I don't have an opinion on that, whether he actually stole Facebook. What happened was Mark Zuckerberg pulled a prank. Mark Zuckerberg, late one night after a bad date, hacked into all the computers at Harvard and pulled pictures of every girl on campus and created a hot or not website. So everyone voted on who the hottest girl at Harvard was. This ended up crashing the servers at Harvard, and Mark almost got kicked out of school. Mm-hmm. He got in all the newspapers, and he came to the attention of these two guys, the Winklevoss twins, identical twin Olympic rowers, 6'5", good-looking, at the top of the athletic chain. They were working on a website called Harvard Connection, which was kind of a dating website. And when they saw Mark, they decided they needed him as their geek. So they brought Mark in to write their computer code. Mark never really wrote their computer code. He kind of blew them off, and then he launched Facebook. So they believe that it was their idea that Mark stole. Mm-hmm. Mark believes that their idea was insignificant and that he created something very different. And you know what? I see both sides of it. I don't really pass a judgment on it.
I'm going to grab a quick quote from the book here, and this is going back to the very beginnings of it when Mark was working on it. The thing that would drive this social network was the same thing that drove life at college, sex. Even at Harvard, the most exclusive school in the world, it was all really about sex, getting it or not getting it. That's why people joined clubs. That's why they chose certain classes over other ones, sat in certain seats, the dining hall. It was all about sex. And deep down, at its heart, that's what the Facebook would be all about in the beginning, an undercurrent of sex. So there's a lot of sex in your book.
Sex.
You know, people having sex, people wanting sex, Facebook being potentially designed so that people could score at college.
Right. Welcome to sophomore year at college, right?
Well, exactly. Except, you know, all those sort of impulses of our sophomore year of college don't turn into something that becomes a genuine kind of business tool.
Right. I call it the next step in human evolution. I mean, I think Facebook is the most important thing that's happened on the internet in many years. But it did start with a couple kids who were looking to meet girls and become cool. You know, the whole term of poking someone on Facebook, There's rumors that that really was, you know, in the beginning at Harvard, you would poke the person you were trying to hook up with.
Let's talk about Eduardo Saverin, I guess is his full name. He's a fellow student who put up the original seed money. Originally, he had a 30% ownership stake that he would say, I think he was tricked out of, swindled out of, something like that, right? What are the lessons, you think, that we can take from his experience with this whole thing?
I think the main lesson is that when you start a business with someone, you got to have some paperwork. And I know these were naive kids in college, and you don't expect college kids to have paperwork. But the Winklevosses experienced, too, and they had no paperwork either.
And the other lesson that I came away from his story with was he chose to stay in school—
in a way, because, you know, Mark Zuckerberg took off for California and dove into the site, and he went to an internship in New York and continued to produce for Facebook and to work hard on its behalf, but didn't throw himself, even though he would purport to believe in this thing, he didn't throw himself 200% into it.
Right. And if you were sitting there in college and you're like, oh, this Facebook looks cool, you know, to give up everything and chase it, it was a risky proposition. But I mean, basically, if you're going to do something entrepreneurial, you have to throw yourself entirely into it. I mean, you have to give up everything and chase it as far as you can go.
What's your sense of where Facebook can go? They seem to have kind of a Google-esque global domination somewhere in their future. You think that's where it's going?
I think it's growing so quickly that pretty soon a quarter of the world will be on it. I see no reason why it doesn't swallow up Twitter and swallow up all these other little things, because it's more perfect than any of the other social networks.
More perfect? What do you mean by that?
Well, look at MySpace. I mean, MySpace is a free-for-all. It's almost disturbing. You know, it's people, look at me, look at me, look at me. And then you look at Twitter. And I enjoy Twitter. I love Twitter. I use it every day. But I've heard it called the Macarena of the internet. I mean, it's the kind of thing where you have fun with it for 2 days, and then you're like, well, why am I using this? That doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. Facebook is something very different in that it really is your social network on the web. It's changed how people date. It's changed how people meet people. It's changed everything. And I see no reason why it doesn't just swallow up anything else that grows.
Ben, it's been fun to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you.
That's Ben Mezrich, and his new book is The Accidental Billionaires, The Founding of Facebook, A Tale of Sex, Money, Genius, and Betrayal. Well, I won't belabor the point here. This is the end of the podcast. Ta-da. And thanks to Sandon Totten, my producer, for helping pull this whole thing together. Once again, you can find us at intheloopshow.net or, of course, very active on Facebook itself at loopfacebook.net, our little shortcut to get you there. I'm Jeff Horwich, and talk to you next week.